And also start the live on Facebook, streaming it to Facebook.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
All right, so the meeting has begun and now we can do announcements, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like Jack has a question.
I have an announcement. The American Physical Society Senior Physicist Group will have a talk this Wednesday at 1 p.m. The speaker will be Harold Williams, and the title of the talk is Nature of Time from the Planck Time Until Now and Maybe Beyond. This will be similar to what Harold presented last month at NCA, but it's certainly well worth listening to. There's a lot of information in that talk.
Sue?
There is a link in the calendar at the bottom of page 7 in Stardust.
Thank you, Jack. Sue?
Yes, the June and July meetings of the Astronomical Society of Greenbelt. Put the information in the chat and I will send it out in groups.io. But these next two meetings are going to be in person only. The June meeting is June 30th, and it is what we call our annual summer film festival, where we screen a space-related movie and discuss the pros and cons, and we will be screening The Martian. This will be a free movie, and it will be at the Greenbelt Community Center. Starting at 7 o'clock, June 30th.
Nice.
The July meeting, instead of our regular date, will be on Saturday, July 23rd. And in cooperation with NASA, this will be a Webb First Light celebration followed by a star party.
Very good.
So that's for June and July. Thank you.
Go ahead, Guy.
I've got a few. One is that on the 25th of June on the mall, not at the same place where it has been in the past, but apparently near 3rd Street, which is near the American Indian Museum, there's going to be an Astrofest. If you haven't been, it's a lot of fun. Unfortunately, there's not going to be many easy targets to find, no planets, no moons, easy to see, but I think it'd be a good place for people to bring your scope if you haven't heard about it before. Another thing I wanted to suggest is if you haven't already joined the NCA listserv, you can send an email to me and I'll, let you join. It's free. So I'm gfbrandenburg@yahoo.com. And you can get on that. And there's often some good stuff. And I'm going to also suggest that people find ways to pressure the University of Maryland one way or another to reopen the observatory so we can continue to have meetings out on Metzerat Road. Oh, and telescope making and modification classes or workshops have resumed Tuesdays and Thursdays at the Chevy Chase Community Center in Northwest Washington. Tuesdays and Fridays from 5 to 8:30. That's it.
Thank you, Guy. I'm going to put your email address into the chat.
Oh,
there you go.
That's a good idea.
There.
Smart.
Okay. And I'll capture the chat messages and can send it out in an email later as well to the group, to rest of the members. Okay, as Guy mentioned, My announcement is I got notification this past week that it will, unless something drastically changes, it will be at least another year before the observatory is reopened to the public. We will have our classes and such as usual with the students, but any public outreach activities are still not being held. In terms of contacting, good luck. Should probably include, you know, if you do the chairman, you should include the college dean of CMNS, and then university president. But apparently the university president has just been forwarding messages back to the department chair, and he's just not happy. And I actually got yelled at the other day because of some of the messages that got forwarded back. Yeah, it's not a great situation. It's very frustrating. But I'm taking advantage of the opportunity of not being there for open houses and such. And so I'm down in St. Croix is my consolation prize. So.
You're in St. Croix right now?
I have been in St. Croix for almost every single one of our meetings this year.
Ugh, suffering, boy.
Yeah, a lot of times I've actually had the sunset happening in the background, but tonight's sunset was, it was very, very hazy, and it actually disappeared before most people got on. So, and it's already dark. It's actually already dark here because we're at 17 North. So the sun has set an hour ago, actually, for us, and it's dark. And my friends are in the swimming pool while I'm in here at the meeting there. So any other announcements?
I'm wondering if there's any point trying to communicate with the University of Maryland for opening up the observatory. It sounds though it's a done deal.
Well, that's what she was just talking about.
Yeah, I don't think it's a done deal. I think they say it's a budgetary thing, according to Elizabeth, but budgets can be changed, especially with pressure.
Yeah, with one night a month, maybe might be able to do it. Wow.
Oh, by the way, those of you who get elected to the board, we'll have to schedule a board meeting at some point this summer.
Okay, so we need, do we need to have a hold elections now or what?
I think so.
Okay.
Jay has his hand raised.
You know, for those people who came in late on exploring the sky, because of staff shortages, for exploring the sky, we cannot get any assistance from the rangers at the Nature Center. And because of that, I technically cannot hold exploring the sky unless I apply for a permit from the National Park Service. And I've done that. I've sent them permits for July, August, September, and October. They've received the permits. I know they've received it. So I'm just waiting for a reply. We'll see what happens. But we would have to hold it on our own. I see no reason why we can't do it. And we've been doing it since 1948. But we'll see what the bureaucrats decide.
Any other announcements? All right, do we have, John, are you the chair of the nominating committee or?
Yes, probably. Okay.
I'll let you take over for the elections.
Okay. the main thing is how to do it. Elizabeth is going to announce each candidate, and before the elections start, in other words, now, look at the reaction button at the bottom of your screen. On my screen, it's at the bottom right. And to vote, you click on that icon to see the options. And when each combination of a candidate and a position is announced, click on either the thumbs up or the thumbs down to indicate your choice.
I would use the check mark or the X mark that are kind of defaults there. There's a green okay. check mark and a red right. X.
Okay.
Would probably be easier. The problem is that we also have several folks who are not technically members, so they have to kind of abstain. And do we have sufficient number of members to actually hold the election?
You know, I don't know what the quorum is.
Yeah.
Anybody know?
All right, so let's see. We've got Jack, me, Jeff, Jay, John, Sue, Guy. QR, are you paid up member?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good. All right, David is technically now a member. David Romeo? Are you a member? I don't have a list of members, so I don't know who on the Zoom is a member or not a member. I'm just
Elizabeth, this is David Romeo. Technically, I'm not a member.
Okay. So
then don't vote.
All right. Then Thomas Dumorod.
Dumorod.
Dumorod. Thomas.
It's he's muted.
Yeah.
Yeah, his video and sound is off. How about Stephanie? I don't recognize that one either.
Yeah, this is Stephanie, but I'm just observing today. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, so those two definitely.
The Dunhams, obviously Jeff and Prasad and Gary Dean are members.
Okay.
I know they get started.
And Todd and yeah.
Todd and Rocco.
Yeah.
They're members.
Okay. All right.
The least 10 people.
And David Fritz is a member too, because.
Yeah, that's right. He is. Yes.
Okay, we got about 15 then. All right, that's good. Fine. All right. I don't know why you think I'm going to read out the things, because I don't have a newsletter in front of me.
I do. Or.
So so you want
I was going to suggest that we vote by acclamation. I think that might be simpler.
Yeah, thank you. So does anyone second the motion by QR?
I second.
All right, I saw Jay's hand go up. All in favor of approving the slate of candidates by acclamation, go ahead and select yay. If you disagree, do the little X. If you abstain, you can do the little left gray buttons or something.
What? You can yell.
Okay.
It's a faux pas.
Okay.
All right, Chris, I'm waiting for a couple folks to still vote.
Joan has it. Oh, I see. Yes.
Okay.
That's thumbs up.
All right. All right. I think it passes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got 12 affirmations. Yeah. Okay.
Any opposed?
They could have used a little X mark instead. Yeah. I didn't see any opposed. There were several people who did not respond, in addition to the ones who we knew would not respond. So I think we're good.
I think we're good.
Okay. All right, so congratulations to whoever the hell we just voted in.
I can read off the names.
Thank you.
There's Guy Brandenburg for president.
Yay!
Me for vice president.
Yay!
Jeff Norman for assistant secretary treasurer.
Yay!
Henry Bofinger for secretary treasurer. Michael Chesney for trustee to June 2023. And Mike Brabansky, trustee to June 2026.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, and so you can use the little reactions button to uncheck yourself now, because it doesn't float away, unfortunately, like the other reactions do. Okay. And
congratulations, all those elected.
Congratulations to all the continuing and new board members. Thank you. Okay, then I think the next thing is for John to introduce our students. We have three student winners, and I think one of them is here tonight to present.
Yeah. The student winners are, let me get to where I am. David Fritz, who had a project, The Life and Death of Sunspots, Tracking Longevity of Active Regions on the Sun. Another winner was Orion Fu, whose project was on powerful quasar-driven outflows in the local universe from the Cosmic Origin Spectrograph Hubble Space Telescope database. And then Helen Mengistu had a project on the effects of space radiation on the medial prefrontal cortex and behavior. In other words, for long duration spaceflight, you better know about that. Okay. So David, if you want to share your screen and, oh, we can't hear you. David, we're not hearing you.
Okay, how about
now? That, yeah.
Got it.
Okay, that's better. Here, let me share my screen.
Good. Okay. Worked.
All right. Hi. My name is David Fritz.
Speak up, please?
Yeah. Okay. Hi, my name is David Fritz. Is this all right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
My project is The Life and Death of Sunspots. So to give you guys some background, sunspots were first described by Chinese astronomers in the 4th century and by Persian and European astronomers. But our understanding of sunspots expanded greatly after the invention of the telescope. Galileo was the first to view the sunspots through the telescope. And through modern research, we've found that these sunspots, which are cooler regions on the surface of the sun, are really just the visual aspect of greater magnetic fields that exist on the sun's surface. And these areas of high magnetic fields are called active regions. So to give you some more background, active regions are often linked with intense like solar flares and CMEs. And it's very important to understand these active regions in order to understand how the sun's magnetism works. And there's also a societal value of learning about these solar events, because if by chance one of them happened to be in line with the Earth's rotation, all of our radio transmission and satellite signaling could be knocked out. And there's also the fact that if we have astronauts on Mars, which doesn't have the same magnetosphere to protect them that our Earth does, If there was a powerful solar explosion or event, those astronauts could be in danger. So there is a very great need to understand these better. So the sun is made up of different layers. You have its core, which is where all the fission occurs. And after that stage of the sun, you have the convective layers in which radiation is carried to the sun's surface. And so you also have this differential rotation of the sun, which is very important to the magnetic fields. Since the sun is not landlocked like the Earth and it's just gas or plasma, the equator of the sun can spin at a much faster rate than the poles. And as a result, you get these huge disparities in rotation speed, in angular rotation speed. So as you can see in the diagram, something rotating at the equator would only take 25 days to complete a solar rotation, whereas it would take around 35 days at the poles. And so as we know, magnetic fields are created by the movement of charged particles. And so this differential rotation, along with the convection, which carries ions to the surface, is what really causes the sun's solar and dynamic magnetism. And if you look down here at this diagram, it does a very good job of explaining how the differential rotation can cause originally straight magnetic field lines to get jumbled up and lead to these intense active regions where the magnetic field is so much higher than the rest of the sun. So tracking active regions as they rotate across the sun can be done manually, but it's a very tedious method. So we use computers to track active regions. And as I talked about before, with the differential rotation, we need to take that into account in order to predict where active regions will be. And the other main problem that we have is that once active regions rotate past the solar disk, past our plane of sight, then we really have no way of observing them. And this continues to be one of the hardest parts of understanding these active regions, is that we just have no way of tracking them or monitoring them for much of their lifespan. So currently the way that scientists label these active regions is a little bit flawed. So you have the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it gives all active regions observed a unique and new number, even if they could be an active region that has already been rotating around the sun, just because they have no idea and they have no way of discriminating between the two. So the main questions are, with the current system, each active region that we observe, we consider to be unique, even though this may not actually be true. So can we match active regions appearing on the sun's eastern limb with previous active regions that have rotated past their line of sight? And if so, what can these matches teach us about active regions and solar magnetism? So my project, which I did last summer at NASA, was to analyze a comprehensive database, a NOAA database of greater than 1,600 sunspots, and to try to generate possible matches between these sunspots. By matches, I mean, so if we go back to this diagram right here, the sun rotates from the east limb, which is on this side, to the west limb. So any active regions that would be coming back around the backside of the sun should appear in this orange area that I've highlighted. And so my goal was to look at this region and to test the active regions here to see if they possibly could have been the same exact region that we may have observed earlier in this yellow zone. And so I had two hypotheses, the first one being that there are very few active regions that persist for more than one solar rotation. And the other was that they would show an characteristic increase in size as their magnetic fields decay over time. So how did I go about doing this? So the first thing was I had to obtain the spreadsheet and import it into Python. And as you can see, the database had a variety of data that I could use to test different hypotheses. The next part was to predict the new coordinates of observed active regions in order to test if they would be similar to active regions observed in the orange area. And so the criteria that I used to match these up was, first of all, similar latitude. As you can see in this diagram, throughout rotation, the latitude does not vary at a great scale. And the other criterion which I used was date. So if you have the expected date somewhat similar to the observed date in which NOAA had put that in, it would be likely for it to be the same. And I was able to identify 168 unique ARs and their matches. So I'll talk more about the results of that in a little bit. So my H1 or hypothesis one, that relatively few ARs persist. So I found that of the 785 ARs that were first observed in this yellow zone, so those being likely to have really formed in that area, there were 168 of those 785 that had unique matches that appeared in this orange crescent. So in other words, there were 168 of those which could be possible matches for active regions forming in here that I now think to be the same exact one just later on. And so these results suggest a 21% survival rate. And I do have to say that there is some possible room for error, because although it's most likely that active regions observed in this zone would be regions rotating around the solar disk, those could just have been active regions that formed in that area. So it's not exact, but I think it's a very good estimate. And so to test H2, that the area of the AR has increased over time, so I compared the original active region areas with their matches, and I found that the size did increase by a rate of 276%. And this could have been because as the AR decayed, it grew in size and its magnetic strength and field dispersed as well. So just to reiterate my results, in support of my first hypothesis, only 21% of the ARs survive for more than one solar rotation. It did for H2. I also learned that the individual AR areas increased approximately 276%, which confirmed that they increase in size. And these two insights give us more information about ARs and their dynamics, which is important for understanding how the sun really functions. And so in addition to those results, having this database is very useful for future researchers in this field, because by using this database of ARs and their possible matches, researchers kind of have a jumping off point in which they can study ARs in which they're fairly confident that have survived more than one rotation, and that can help them just cut out some of the time and get right into it. And final notes. So my analysis was not able to identify ARs that rotated more than one rotation, so two rotations or three, although previous studies have shown that some active regions can persist for up to a period of months. And another important aspect to test would have been the actual strength of the magnetic fields in the ARs during their lifetime, but the database that I was working with didn't have this information. And just one thing to mention that isn't feasible right now, but perhaps in a few decades we could explore, would be to position a solar probe or a telescope of sorts on the far side of the sun, so that we would have this continuous data on active regions. And as it's pretty obvious that you can't send data directly through the sun, which is why this is such a problem. But if we could boomerang this with a couple probes or satellites, then we would have this continuous data, although it would be at a great expense. And that's why no one's really thinking about doing that right now. And so that's all I have. Thank you for having me here today. And if anyone has questions, anyone can ask right now.
Let's unmute ourselves and thank the speaker.
Yes, thank you. All right, Jay has a question.
Yeah, a couple of points. One, we've had a satellite or two satellites called Stereo,
yeah,
which have done somewhat what you talked about.
Yeah.
They went around the sun. The problem is they've sort of met up, I think, on the other side of the sun. They didn't stay right where we wanted them. But for part of the time, we did have a 360-degree image of the sun, but we don't have that at this time. The other point is that we do know the longitude and the latitude of each sunspot on the sun. If you go to some of the sunspot sites, even right, NASA, they do give you the coordinates of each sunspot group. So you can get some of that data now.
Yeah, you're right about that. The database that I was working with only had the coordinates at one specific place where it was observed. But yeah, I don't know exactly why I didn't have that type of data, but either way, we still don't have the data as it goes on the opposite side of the sun. And
that we don't have. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a comment and a couple of comments. About the effects of solar activity on us down here. During the 1800s, after telegraph networks had been set up, there was a coronal mass ejection that pretty much hit the Earth.
1859.
Okay, 1859.
That was the Carrington event, right?
Yeah.
Carrington event.
And it actually electrocuted a lot of telegraph operators. Yeah. Just the induction effects. And another thing is that protection against radiation, especially CMEs, is probably one of the biggest reasons why we haven't sent humans further than to the moon. In other words, it would take so long to get to Mars or something like that, that there'd be a big likelihood of a dangerous radiation event that we don't have a way of protecting them, right, against. Are there any other questions or? Oh, Jeff has one. Jeff, you're muted.
Jeff, you're muted.
Oh, which Jeff are you referring to?
Jeff Norman. Jeff Norman.
Okay,
he's muted.
Okay, am I unmuted now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, then the question is this. Did you at all look into the effects of sunspot cycles on the climate on the Earth? We've heard things about solar cycles, 11-year and 22-year cycles. Do you know anything about that?
I do know about the solar cycle that at the maximum, it's more likely for there to be CMEs and solar flares. But I don't know if the solar maximum is linked with higher temperatures on Earth. I do imagine that since more radiation is being produced, it would, but I actually haven't looked into that.
All right, I can give you a little an answer on that. We have satellites in space that have looked at the bolometric energy coming out of the sun, and it does vary over a solar cycle, but it's only 0.1%. So it's a very small amount, and no matter what the size of the cycle is, it still only varies the same. So it does not have an effect. The sunspot cycle strength has no effect on the weather and climate.
Well, wasn't there a little ice age in the 1600s? And I thought that had something to do with the sunspot cycle.
No.
You're talking about the Maunder minimum?
No. Yeah. No, because that was right in the middle. And the little ice age began before and ended after. So the Maunder minimum was not affected by it.
Okay.
There is an effect of the solar cycle on the very uppermost part of the atmosphere, where it's so dilute that the trajectories of atoms and molecules are ballistic, rather than what you get in a medium and thermodynamic equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium. And that has some effect on Earth orbiting spacecraft. In a project I was connected with, the mechanical engineer didn't know much about how things worked in space, unfortunately. And the lubricant he used would outgas, and the hydrocarbons would condense on whatever was coolest on the spacecraft. And that turned out to be the lenses of our instrument. But at solar max, so we would lose 2/3 of our signal eventually from that. But whenever solar maximum came, this exosphere inflated and more atomic oxygen hit the spacecraft and actually chemically mostly cleaned off our window, and we got most of our signal back. That happened with two instruments. So it's a really useful effect to know about. Another thing to know about is that there's called the South Atlantic anomaly that spacecraft operators and engineers have to know about. It's an area in the Atlantic, not far from Brazil, where the Earth's magnetic field is somewhat weak. So more charged particles come through, and that puts your electronics at risk. Chances of some little transistor or something like that latching up. So a lot of spacecraft turn off some of their electronics whenever they pass through that region over the Earth.
And I also remember from, I think from a while ago, I don't know that much about this, but I think the solar cycle is linked to the El Nino winds. But I just remember reading that somewhere. I don't know that much about it.
Yeah, I don't either. But that's interesting. I will look that up. By the way, your talk was really excellent. That was really a nice piece of work.
Thank you.
Yeah, and your work was a nice piece of work. Very good.
Thank you.
Very well done. Thank you.
I agree.
Yeah, the sun is what I look at most of the time with my telescope. Interesting, even though we're going up towards solar maximum, a couple of days ago, there were absolutely no sunspots on the sun.
Wow.
And then the next day, there was one small group appeared, which almost disappeared the next day. It went down almost to nothing. I did not see it. SDO was able to pick it up, but I did not see it.
Wow.
So it's interesting the way the sunspots cycle and the way they appear and disappear, even over the course of one day, the way they can fluctuate. It's fascinating. Interesting thing to follow.
A couple of comments. I didn't know a whole lot about the Stereo Solar Observatory, but it is one instead of two, so it's really mono, not stereo, because one of the satellites died and doesn't look like they do.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, one did. Yeah.
So it doesn't look like they do a very good job of identifying sunspots.
Not anymore. Yeah.
And concerning connections between sunspot cycle and the weather, there's been a lot of speculation about that. Most researchers seem to think that that's not true, that it's not connected. I don't know.
What there is the solar wind is related to the strength of the sunspot cycle. The stronger the solar wind, the fewer cosmic rays come in towards the Earth and hit the Earth. And this can, you know, ionizing the upper atmosphere. So during a strong solar cycle, you've got fewer of these cosmic rays coming in. That might cause some effect.
Oh, one other question to our speaker, if he's still there, David. So what year are you in high school? High school, I guess? Oops.
Yeah, I'm a junior. I just finished my junior year. I guess I'm a senior now, but okay. Heading into senior year.
Where do you go to school?
I live in Chevy Chase, and I go to school in Rockville at a Jewish day school called CES JDS.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah.
Well, keep up the good work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, I got to get a telescope and do some solar observing.
Yeah, I don't have a telescope now, but I really want to get one. So maybe this year I can get one for my birthday.
Actually, Guy can give you a lot of useful information.
Build one at his class.
Well, even about what's the right thing to buy for what you want to do.
Great.
And if you're interested in solar stuff, Jay has the club's Coronado. What is that, a 60 millimeter?
Yeah. Hydrogen Alpha, yes.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
Yeah, actually, I just used it a couple of days ago. No activity, though.
Well, maybe we should give David another round of applause for doing so well on the science fair project.
Yeah.
That's really an impressive one, really is.
Very good.
Although we've had our election, there's one thing I'd like to say that's tangentially related to that. I'd like to really express the NCA's gratitude to Todd Supple and to Elizabeth Warner, who have put in an enormous amount of work
Absolutely.
To keep this organization going and interesting.
Yes.
To be a member of.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You probably noticed in the Stardust the very interesting material in the sidebars, unrelated to the talk, but giving a lot of interesting new results that have been discovered by astronomers and astrophysicists. And Todd is the one who finds all those things and puts them in there. So thanks again, Todd.
Thanks to all the contributors and proofreaders for helping make that possible. Thank you.
I just want to say that I check these out on a regular basis and follow the links, and I find them very, very fascinating.
Yeah, they really are.
Thank you very much.
Okay, are there any final announcements? Or Stephanie, you'd posted something in the chat. Do you want to maybe talk about it? Or
sure, I don't want to, you know, put us off schedule, but I did want to let people know about the Shore Leaf Convention coming up. It's amazing how the science programming has expanded at these science fiction conventions. I remember back in the day, a scientist wouldn't be caught dead at one of these things. Now they run the things, big scientist receptions, observing at night. So I have put a link in the chat for Shore Leaf coming up in Baltimore next month, but there are a lot of other events throughout the year that could use more presenters and astronomy educators, especially community type educators. So join us at Shore Leaf if you can. Thank you.
At the end of the chat, there's also a recommendation, which I suspect Guy or Jay put in, recommending a particular telescope.
Actually, that was Stephanie, I think.
Okay, very good.
Yeah,
the Coronado is 60. That's the hydrogen alpha one that NCA has that I keep at my house.
And I keep one at my house too, so highly recommended.
What I want to do is bring it to the farmer market in Bethesda, that one or my regular solar telescope. Almost did last week, but I got to get my system set up yet. Maybe in another week or so, I'll bring one of the two telescopes out to the farm market in Bethesda.
Hey, question. Those of you with the Coronado telescopes, and I've got one myself now. Do you have any tips for actually finding the sun in it? It's got that little sort of pinhole finder device, but even using that, I have a terrible time finding the sun. I had it out, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? No, and I just could not
find the sun no matter what I did, that it swept back and forth and up and down and recentered it in the little finder device, and all I could get that was a red disk that never moved. So it was clearly some sort of like internal reflection or so.
No, I had problems. I had problems also. And finally, what I did is I got a nice round image. And when I moved that to the center, and I was able to get it in focus, and I had an image of the sun. So yeah, it took a little playing around, but that was only because I hadn't used the telescope in a while. It worked.
Guy had raised his hand.
Yeah, I haven't done it yet, but apparently you have to replace the blocking filter every so often. At least the personal solar telescope, which is also made, I believe, by Coronado. After a while, one of the surfaces of one of the filters gets blocked by oxidation. So I took mine out to see things and couldn't see anything. And after having not used it for a couple of years because it was at minimum, and then I looked on various forums and they said what you have to do is order a new filter. And apparently the filter looks like this. And I have not yet taken mine apart to see what it actually looks like. This is a piece of paper, and on there are a couple of little thingies, and I haven't played with them yet to see exactly how to put that back in.
Okay, all right. Yeah, probably wouldn't hurt to do that because our telescope is quite a few years old.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll contact. Who makes? I don't remember who makes the Coronado.
I believe Mead makes them now.
Mead doesn't exist anymore.
That they don't exist?
I don't think they do.
But I believe that telescope was originally developed by Lunt, and is Lunt still selling his solar scopes?
Lunt does, yeah.
Yeah, those were developed by him, so you could probably try and contact him too.
Okay, all right.
I got the filter from someplace else.
Okay. Very good.
I hope it works.
Okay, unless there's other announcements, then I propose we end the meeting and have a good summer.
All right.
Thank you.
If I hear anything on exploring the sky, I'll put it on our groups.io.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for attending.
Bye. Thank you again,
Donnie.
Thank you. Have a good summer.
Okay.
Everyone, have a good summer.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.